Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Theater Podcast, intimate personal conversations with theater's biggest names. I'm Alan Seals.
I'm Jillian Hockman.
And this episode is with Brandon Uranowitz, who is currently in Burn This on Broadway, which I guess it's not ironically his first play, because he's done musicals his entire career until this point.
Yeah, even though he trained for plays and drama.
That doesn't seem like an uncommon thing, actually. There's a lot of people who really come out of these great conservatories with some classical training, and then they just do like weird, crazy musicals for years and years and years.
Whatever pays the bills.
Yeah. Part of what I really loved about the interview with him is like we got deep into the story, like his coming out story and being a gay Jew in New Jersey, and kind of like I won't say shame, but sort of the internal struggle he had when, I don't want to spoil the coming out story, but he tells it when his parents sort of forced his hand, but then he lied about it and then convinced them that he wasn't gay. Then he was relieved and upset all at the same time.
Welcome to being a Jew in New York. It's a very cultural Northeast American thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's something that I'm sure many a person has had some sort of experience with when they come from this world.
And he said something else too that really resonates with me. That now in Burn This, it's the first, he's a gay man, and now in Burn This, he's the first openly gay character he's gotten to play as a gay man in real life.
Mm-hmm.
And he made the point, it's like, why did it take so long to get there? There are just not enough characters who are gay, who are the central focus of a storyline where being gay is not the focus of the story.
Mm-hmm. It's always been that thing that makes you different. Well, it's starting to become not that different anymore.
Yeah, I guess it probably never was that different. It's just now that we're able to talk about it.
Exactly.
That everyone is just, yeah, we see it everywhere, we notice it, and it shouldn't be a thing anymore. I totally agree with him. It just should just be. That's part of who people are.
2019, not a thing.
All right, everybody. Please enjoy this episode here with Brandon Uranowitz. He's a two-time Tony-nominated actor, best known for his roles as Adam in An American in Paris and Mendel in the 2016 Broadway revival of Falsettos. Both roles resulted in his Tony nominations and also got a Drama Desk Award nomination for Falsettos. With credits that also include The Prince of Broadway and the touring production of Rent, he's most recently been in The Band's Visit on Broadway and has appeared in TV productions, including The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Dietland, Blue Bloods, and Inside Amy Schumer. He is about to open Burn This on Broadway. Brandon Uranowitz, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. So let's start where we normally start on this podcast, and let's go back to your humble roots, your humble beginnings. Mm-hmm. Tell me where you grew up.
I grew up in West Orange, New Jersey. A little closeted gay Jewish boy who wasn't very good at sports and very uncoordinated. And my parents took me to see Peter Pan when I was three. And that sort of sparked this whole passion for theater and storytelling. I mean, apparently my mom had never seen my face look like that before. And that's when she knew, when I was watching them fly around the theater, I guess. I don't know. I still have yet to fly in a theater, so I'm still just like hoping and praying one day that'll happen.
But do you want to be Wendy or Peter?
Wendy.
Oh, obviously. Of course. Yes, yes.
Obviously, Wendy.
So then from there, three-year-old Brandon goes back and says, "I want to do this," or what happened after that?
No, I didn't necessarily vocalize that, but I think my parents saw something in me and could see my lack of athletic skills and decided to put me in, you know, some like extracurricular theater schools. Namely Performers Theater Workshop in Livingston, New Jersey. And I, you know, for a good portion of my childhood, you know, probably from the age of 6 to 17, I was at PTW like 3 times a week, doing private voice lessons, song interpretation class, acting class, obviously jazz and tap.
So being uncoordinated, you were still doing jazz and tap?
Yeah, I managed to somehow be a somewhat decent dancer, mover, somewhat decent mover. Those skills have since waned a bit. I haven't really like worked on that brain muscle in a while, so picking up choreography is like not my forte.
That's interesting though. I mean, because an American in Paris, it's heavy dancing, heavy ballet.
For everybody but me.
Yeah?
Yeah. I had, my character had a war injury, so I was limping around the stage, except for a nice fantasy tap number, which, I can tap dance.
That's funny. So six until when you were saying you were performing?
Like 17.
17, okay.
And because I grew up right outside New York City and right near Paper Mill Playhouse, mm-hmm. I somehow hoodwinked my family into letting me try it professionally. And I did. I did a Vita at Paper Mill when I was 9. I turned 10. And then I did a Christmas Carol at Madison Square Garden. And then I went and I played the little boy in the world premiere of Ragtime in Toronto.
Oh, wow.
When I was 11. Yeah.
So you had got all the child credits in there.
I did. And then, I mean, if you really want to get deep and like dive in here, I was playing the little boy in Toronto and, you know, it's a show about, you know, immigrants and African Americans and, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants living in America and those race relations. And there was a little Jewish boy playing this little waspy boy, mm-hmm. and they were bleaching my hair and my eyebrows every 2 weeks.
No kidding.
Yeah. And I don't know. I think it was just weird for them maybe to have someone named Brandon Uranowitz playing the little waspy boy. And they let me go before they came to Broadway. So that sort of thickened my skin at a young age and prepared me a little bit for the inevitable rejection that you face on a daily basis in this industry. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I worked professionally for a little bit. I came back and did this thing called Broadway Kids, which was like an off-Broadway skit. And we recorded a couple of albums. And then I got bar mitzvahed and sort of realized that I didn't have like a core group of friends really at that time. I was constantly leaving school to audition and I was not at school for big swaths of time rehearsing or doing a show. And it was lonely a little bit for me as a kid. And so I stopped for a while and just went and finished middle school and went to high school. And I knew I still wanted to perform. I knew I still wanted to be an actor. But I needed to be a human and do normal human people things.
I've heard that from others who were performing a lot as children, that they just wanted to take a break and just like be a kid for a while.
Yeah, and I think it was an important decision, and I'm very happy that I did it. Those are your formative developmental years, right, where you learn basic social skills and how to relate to people. And, you know, being in the closet brought its own set of challenges. So, I had enough to contend with, I guess.
Well, yeah, I want to get into your coming out story because I saw, uh-oh, we'll get into it in a second.
Okay,
I saw your, on an episode of Side by Side with Susan Blackwell. I think it was at Stephanie J. Block's house.
It sure was.
So where you told your coming out story, which was quite funny. But
we'll get into it. It's not actually my coming out story. It's my almost coming out story.
Okay, well, let's just tell the story. Just tell the story.
Are you sure?
Yeah, yeah, because, well, I want to, okay, well, hold on to that, listeners.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We'll get there.
Put a pin in that. I want to ask about your parents, though. How traditionally Jewish are they, or were they? You know, because when I'm thinking, they seemed obviously very supportive, and they were like, we're going to give our child everything he wants and let him be this child star and let him audition and take him out of school, and that, you know, I don't, that doesn't necessarily jive with, like...
Yeah, no, no, no. Yeah. I mean, I did not grow up in, like, a religious kosher household. We did go to, I mean, I went to Hebrew school every Sunday, Tuesday, and Thursday, even though I tried with all of my might to get out of it every single time. And we went to, like, a conservative Jewish temple on high holidays and things like that. And we celebrated Passover and, you know, we had a Seder and Rosh Hashanah. But it never really sort of permeated into our, like, daily lives. Mm-hmm. I think it was more about... My mom grew up in a kosher household, and my dad's parents went to temple. And I think it was just them sort of holding on to tradition. And I mean, you know, that's a huge part of Jewish culture is the tradition, the traditions that they withhold and not withhold that they keep.
I can't think of the word.
I know what you're trying to say. You know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, yeah.
It was more about the tradition. And they wanted me to get bar mitzvah, and they wanted my sister to get bat mitzvah. But it was never really about the religion of it and the teachings of the Bible and the Torah. Mm-hmm. It was more about the community that is sort of inherent in Jewish tradition. Yeah, I mean, we were very much like New York, New Jersey Jews, you know?
Right. Yeah, yeah. And so I guess along with that, and that's leading into the coming out story was, you know, were they necessarily like pro-LGBT sort of initiatives, or did they not care, or, you know, being around, I think like...
They were sort of ambivalent, I guess. I guess going along with tradition and growing up in New Jersey and I went to a private school. I think for my parents, it wasn't about being gay or that being gay is necessarily a bad thing or mm-hmm. an evil thing or a disgusting life choice or something. I think more for them, it was just the fear of being different and the fear of judgment from the people around them and the people mm-hmm. around me and the kids that I was going to school with. I think they just didn't want me to, they didn't want to deal with that obstacle, and they didn't want me to deal with that obstacle. So I think that was just sort of, and it was not as prevalent. People were not living as openly as they are now, back when I was growing up. So, you know, if we would come into New York City to see a show, which we did all the time, and there was, you know, a gay couple holding hands or kissing on the street, I don't even think my dad was conscious of it or aware of it, because he could not be more supportive of me now and supportive of LGBTQ rights. And that, I would see him wince and I would see him sneer a little bit only because it was different and novel for him.
Right.
And I think it scared him. And I think a lot of parents of gay kids act out of fear more than anything, and I don't think there's malice in their hearts necessarily. I just think it's reactionary and fear based,
fight or flight almost.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, that's interesting. So get into your coming out story then, because I want to know how they reacted.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So I mean, I'm going to just assume that like many of your listeners have probably heard this story. So like apologies in advance if you know what's coming and like if you know my zingers in this story. But for those who don't know, when I was a teenager, the internet was like this new, wonderful, mysterious thing.
How old are you now?
At this point?
Yes.
Like 13, 14.
No, I mean like today, right here.
Oh, right
yeah,
now?
Yeah.
32.
32. Okay, yeah. So you're younger than me. Yeah, so I had a modem.
Okay, yeah, yes. Yeah. No, so but did
yeah,
we.
Yeah, yeah,
we
yeah.
had a modem.
Okay, okay.
And a family computer.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And we all shared it, and it was all very new. Nobody knew how to use this thing.
Do you have Prodigy?
Of course I had Prodigy. And my... My first screen name on Prodigy was Bagels for You. So, good night.
And see.
Yeah. God, I was such a nerd. So the internet was this new thing. We had this new giant machine in the house that nobody really knew how to use. But there was all this cool, interesting stuff you could find on it if you went onto this weird thing called Internet Explorer. You could explore this vast, mysterious world that exists in the ether somewhere. And so at this point, you know, my hormones are developing. I'm starting to have feelings. And I'm realizing that they're not normal, that everybody's sort of expecting me to, and like at this point I am like kissing girls and I'm like canoodling with girls because that's what I was supposed to do. That's like what you humans do, I guess. But
that's
it never,
that's the behavior modeled
right,
everywhere.
Everywhere yeah. you go. That's yeah. what's being advertised to you on TV and magazines, on buses and on, you know, everywhere. And mm-hmm. like, that's my parents and, you know, so, but it never felt natural to me. I was like, this is not, I don't know what, I mean, I guess this is nice. I like cuddling up with someone, but like, I don't really feel the impulse to do this. But I guess I'll continue. But here's this internet thing and, oh, there are some pictures that make me feel things. And, oh, there are some videos that I've stumbled upon. And, oh, those make me feel things that I don't feel when I'm with girls. What is that? And then I, you know, so I, like, continued to explore that very late at night when my parents are sleeping or, you know, weekend afternoon when they're at the mall, you know, I would go to the family computer and explore these feelings. And I thought because, you know, I mean, I feel like this is true today also that, I mean, this will always be true that like the younger generation is always a little more savvy with the like evolution of technology.
Of course.
So I knew at that point that like you always delete your browser history, right? Like that's right. just, that's what you do. I don't know how I knew that. I mean, one of my best friends, Michael, at the time was like very, very into computers. And I guess I probably like learned from him that that's a thing that you do. And so I was very diligent about deleting my browser history. And one day, I'm in eighth grade, and this is where some people will know where this story goes. I'm at my friend Nicole's house, who I met at PTW, mm-hmm. Doing theater and dance. And we were choreographing a hip-hop dance, because that's what we liked to do. And we also would, like, teach it to younger kids. So I was at her house choreographing a hip-hop dance, and I get a call from my mother on my Nokia cell phone, and it sounds very urgent, very dire, and there's darkness in her voice. And she's like, "Where are you? You need to come home right now." And I was like, "Is everything okay?" She's like, "Yes, it's fine. You just need to come home now." And I was like, okay. So like Nicole and I finished choreographing, and I was like, I guess I have to go home. So she drove me home. And I walk into the house, and my mom is standing in complete darkness in the kitchen with this like neon light just sort of like backlighting her. And it's very creepy and scary. She looks terrifying. And I walk in and I'm like, what's up? And she like steps out of the shadows like a murderer. And she's like, follow me. We need to talk about something. And she leads me down into the like family, whatever office, which was like not really, it was like the mud room, to the computer. And in complete anger and like disgust, she starts like very rapid fire opening all of these files, and they link to internet sites of like pretty hardcore porn, like yeah. gay porn.
Yeah.
And I'm completely caught off guard. And talk about fight or flight. Like my immediate reaction is to just pretend that I have no clue what this is. And on top of that, pretend like I'm disgusted by it because I can't let her know that this is like mine. So I'm just standing there being like, ew, that's so disgusting. That's so gross. Like, stop showing this to me. Why are you doing this to me? And then she like started, and then like my dad came down and like just his under, it was like so, it was so
just
weird.
He
was like
underwear.
Just his like tidy whiteies. And he was like, Brandon, like if it's yours, we can deal with it. Like, let's talk about it. And like, and they just like keep showing. And then all of a sudden, and like, obviously it's mine. Like I can also just like, in my brain, obviously I've cataloged all of this. I'm like, oh yeah, that was like last Thursday. Like
right,
that was
right.
Sunday. Like I know. And then like, out of like a miracle, I guess it wasn't really a miracle because this probably would have like just solved a lot of issues for the next couple of years. But out of nowhere, they opened this other file that was like some weird fax document thing that like nobody recognized. And so like immediately I'm like, oh, well, we're obviously being hacked. Like someone hacked into our computer and is just like looking at porn on
they hacked in a remote computer to look at porn.
Correct.
Makes total sense.
Correct, right?
Yeah.
They believed me though. Like they bought it.
Wow.
They bought it. And but like that's not how computers work. That's not how it works.
Right.
These are files that were saved on the hard drive of the. So basically we found out that like, or I found out what happened was the computer was acting really slowly, and my dad's brother, Seymour, was very computer savvy. Like he was, I think he taught like computer science or something mm-hmm. out in Minnesota. And they called him to be like, our computer's acting really slowly. We don't know what's up. How do we fix it? And he was like, well, have you deleted your temporary internet files? And that's when they found this just like plethora of gay porn sites. Because I guess... you know, at that time, I don't know if it's still true. I don't know how, and I use a Mac now, so I don't know. But like it would save, it would log.
It caches your images. Yeah, yeah. yeah.
Not just images, like the web, the link, like
oh,
the,
yeah, yeah.
the URLs.
Oh, so they went in manually and to go delete those. Oh man, okay, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
Just like thousands.
Oh, of course.
But they believed me that we were hacked. And like, so I didn't, I almost had to come out, but like, then they started apologizing, like my mom started crying, like she just felt so terrible Oof. That they had accused me of something I had very much done.
Well, how did that feel?
It was weird. It was a weird experience.
Because you're relieved they don't know, but you want them to know so badly.
Correct.
Yeah.
It was a weird dissonant experience for me because I was so relieved that I didn't have to deal with it then. And I guess at the time, I was like, oh, maybe I'll never have to deal with it.
Hmm.
Maybe I'll just live my life. I'll marry a woman. I'll have a family and I'll deal with these feelings on my own. At that point, I didn't really have any reference point for gay relationships.
You didn't know any other gay people in your life?
Not really. I mean, I knew them from, you know, working in theater. Like,
right.
They were around. But there was no it really lasting imagery or, again, like reference point for gay love for me or relationships. So for me, it just felt like it was purely connected to and related to sex. So those are feelings I felt like I could deal with privately, but like love and relationships and partnership I could find with a woman. I mean, all of my friends were girls, you know what yeah. I mean? So I was like, oh, that's what will happen. That's how this will go. And then I went to college and I was like, no. Because it started affecting my work.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting that, I mean, I think even with, you know, as a straight teenager myself, at you know, I'm not a teenager anymore, but it is.
You look it.
No, I'm 38. I am almost in my 40s.
Don't look a day over 37.
Thank you. Someone checked me the other day to get my eyebrows waxed for the first time. So
they look nice.
Thank you.
Very on fleek, as they say.
On fleek, that's what the kids say these days.
That's what they say. I think it's like about eyebrows. I think that's where
really?
On fleek came from.
I couldn't.
Was about eyebrows. You. Well, yours are on fleek.
Well, thank you. I now have to continue this trend because I think they look rather nice.
They do.
Yes. What was I saying? Oh, yeah. So for me, I remember like, at the same age, I was looking at porn on my computer and my dad actually found it and he pulled me aside and he said, just don't show your brother because I was the older brother. He didn't care.
He was probably proud.
Yeah, he was like, all right, cool, my boy's straight.
Yeah.
But what was modeled for me too was all sex because on TV and in cable and like you don't have these big love stories. That's not what sells. It's like sex sells. Love doesn't sell a lot of times, at least to men. Like to men.
Oh. Especially to men.
Especially to men, right? Yeah. Like, men in rom-coms are not marketed to men. So, I think in just a comment on that in general, like, our society needs to get some more love modeled for our kids.
Come on. I mean, it's... for a society that's so predicated on partnership and families, you'd think that the element of love would sort of guide it, but it really doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
It's getting better, particularly for the gay community, I think.
Yeah.
It's on its way. You know, I'm still waiting for that story, that film, that play where a gay character's sexual orientation is not the central conflict of the story. I mean...
Nick Offerman movie... that just came out, Hearts Beat Loud.
Oh, yeah.
Go see that.
Okay.
Nick Offerman's daughter in the movie is a lesbian, and it's just there.
See?
It's not the central conflict.
Oh,
she has a girlfriend
God.
That is just comes in and out of scenes, and there's like, you know.
Is she the main character?
It's about Nick Offerman, really.
Okay.
So it's about the relationship between.
I mean, it's sort of, I'm still waiting for that story where the gay character is the center of the film. And I mean, I guess it's hard in it these days to not comment on it, but I'm still waiting for a film that centers around a gay character where like the central conflict is something completely other.
What about Doctor Who?
I don't really know Doctor Who.
So some of Doctor Who's companions have been gay and that's just there.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. In the remake, not the original,
right.
Obviously. But
fair enough.
Yeah. So there's a couple out there,
okay.
But to your point, I don't think there's been a big blockbuster movie central to
no. And like, look,
it's character.
Baby, it's baby steps, and I'm happy with the steps we're taking. With you know, Love, Simon, and all of that. I mean, I'm very, very happy about that. But
right. So then, when did you actually come out? Though we never got there yet.
Oh yeah, I guess we haven't. I was still in the closet my freshman year of college, even though I was secretly hooking up with a boy. And I was at the
NYU.
I was at NYU.
Yep.
I was in the Meisner studio. And all of year one at Meisner is all about discovering your inner emotional life and opening yourself up to revealing that emotional life on stage and accessing it on stage, or on film and TV, like whatever, just in scenes and in scene work. And I was completely closed off to it, and I was not thriving really in it because we weren't doing. I mean, I at that point, I think I was a decent, good actor, but I could play characters. And when it came to personalizing things as Brandon, because it was all personal, that work, I was completely closed off and stunted, and I couldn't figure out why. I started having really, really bad panic attacks. I like ended up in the emergency room like 4 times that year thinking I was dying. And I was just sort of like spiraling because I just felt like a shell a little bit. I didn't have any access to anything inside of me because I was trying to break through like titanium walls.
You're just trying to keep it out of your mind completely.
Well, yeah, right. I was just trying to do anything I could to maintain this lie, I guess.
Did at this point in your own head, did you know you were gay? Or were you just trying to convince yourself you weren't? Like, were you trying to believe your own?
No, I knew. I mean, it's just a... That's always a tough question because, like, I've always known. But denial is like a very, very powerful thing. Mm-hmm. And a very manipulative thing. And I think I had manipulated myself into believing I was somebody else a little bit. Anyway, so I was contending with a lot of, you know, failure in my work, anxiety and like panic attacks in my life. And I sort of reached a fever pitch and I started seeing a therapist and I started taking anxiety medication and slowly but surely, you know, the mist started to clear a little bit and everything became clear. And I realized what I had to do. And so like sophomore year of college is when I finally started telling the people closest to me in Meisner. I think they were like sort of the first few people I told. I actually told my sister on my 20th birthday. Yeah. Or 19th birthday.
Maybe 19 or 20 at sophomore, yeah.
19 or 20th birthday. And then I told my mom, who was still surprised, but cool with it. You know, she cried. I think she, again, sort of believed what I just said about, you know, denial being very powerful. And she had convinced herself that, you know, she would see me at the altar with a woman or something. I don't know, some like weird old like baby boomer traditional bullshit.
Right.
But then, you know, I mean, she said to me, she's like, obviously being gay is a huge part of who you are. That is a major part of the fiber of your being. And we love you as you are, and we don't want you to be anybody different. So if being straight means that you are different than you are, we don't want that. Like, we want you as you, we love you as you. And it's been amazing. I have a boyfriend that I've been with for 8 years, and they've accepted him as a son, and it's beautiful and wonderful and amazing, and they've been incredible. So it was touch and go there for a while.
When you told your dad, you said, "Dad, I need you in your underwear right now."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Actually, I mean, I never actually physically told my dad. My mom, I was like, "Mom, you can tell Dad. I can't. Like, it's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really nice. I mean, that's as good of a story as anybody could hope for.
Yeah.
Do you ever joke about the discovery of the porn on the computer? Did anybody talk about that?
Oh my God. With my family?
Yeah.
Oh
yeah.
Yeah. And I think it still is like a little bit of a sore spot for them. Because I think they feel bad. I think they feel like they were not great parents in that moment. But I don't blame them. Parenting is fucking hard.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and as much as I was contending with the social, you know, obstacles of being gay, they were dealing with the social obstacles of, you know, being parents and being protective of their kids. Like, I don't blame them at all.
Is your sister older or younger?
Younger.
So do you look out for her? Does she look out for you at all? Are you guys?
Yeah, we both do. Yeah. We're really close. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed that story. That was good.
I'm glad.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
But how about we talk about some theater, huh?
Let's do it.
You wanna, since this is the theater podcast.
Sure, let's talk about some theater.
Some theatre. So NYU, of course. And then what was your major when you graduated?
Drama.
Drama, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I didn't really study musical theater at school. I was in Meisner for 2 years, then I went into classical for a year, which was Shakespeare. And,
yeah. I found, I think it was Wesley Taylor actually was telling me that, like, at School of the Arts where he went, he did a lot of drama and classical Shakespeare and all this stuff. And then his first Broadway gig was
Rock of Ages.
Rock of Ages, right. Which is like a complete opposite of Shakespeare. But yeah. He was saying, like, the classical stuff really trains you.
It does. I mean, I think I'm so thankful that I stopped working as a kid so that I could go to high school and take a class called, modern drama, where I learned about Sam Shepard and, you know, August Wilson and Eugene O'Neill and Tennessee Williams. And like, I read the greats and fell in love with drama and theater and plays.
Yeah.
Because that's what sort of inspired me to go to NYU and really focus on the acting. And I think it's a huge part of why I'm where I am now, is that I was able to really sink my teeth into the challenges of telling a story and playing actions and having relationships and being with your scene partner and connecting with them and, you know?
Right. But most of your professional credits have been musicals, no?
Correct.
Yeah. So how did you make that transition?
I mean, you know, I did PTW. Like, I mean, a lot of my training as a kid was in musical theater. I worked in musical theater as a kid. And like, funnily enough, when I was at NYU, I didn't do any musicals except for my final semester when I got cast in the main stage musical, which was an original musical called Only Children. And I was playing one of the leads, and an agent came to it. And I mean, it was just sort of like weird, fateful things. You know, an agent came, and that's how I got my representation. They saw me in a musical.
Mm-hmm.
And so And, you know, as an actor, you sort of want as many possibilities. It's a numbers game, right? So you want as many possibilities as possible at your fingertips to try and book work. And so they were like, oh, he can sing. So I was sent out for musicals as well. And sort of the musical theater niche is what bit first. And that's sort of where I saw, that's where my career ended. And I just sort of like went where it took, where the wind blowed. So it's not really where I saw my career going, but it's been amazing.
Well, yeah.
It's been really special. And I have loved doing musical theater. And I have loved particularly bringing what I learned at NYU and bringing my training as an actor to musicals. I think...
They go hand in hand.
Yeah, I mean, I do have a little bit of an issue with people. I mean, it's been impossible for me to burn this as sort of like maybe the only, I don't want to say it's the only because I don't have the actual numbers, but there can't be more than like four or five like plays that I've been seen for. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's impossible for me to even get seen for them because for whatever reason, people say musical theater is one thing and straight theater is another.
Right.
And as far as I'm concerned, they're the exact same thing. There's just a melody involved in one of them. And you have to sing on certain pitches in another. But it's the exact same thing. You are trying to tell the truth and bring authenticity to a story and convince an audience of, you know, certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no difference. So it sort of bothers me a little bit when, you know, I get put into this box of musical theater thinking, like, as if I can't do the other, but it's the same thing.
Yeah. Well, hopefully this will kind of break you out of that pattern a little bit. I mean, going back over your credits, you were Mark in the national tour of Rent, and you made your Broadway debut in Baby It's You in 2011. Mm-hmm. And just a quick question about that. You originated a role as your Broadway debut. At that time, did you know how special that was?
I did.
Did you?
I did. I mean, yes. I mean, that show came with quite a few challenges, but... I knew how lucky I was at that time and how rare that is in this business. And especially in my debut, I knew it was special.
Yeah. That's good. I was going to say
yeah, that. You know, the thing is that show was, did not really succeed. It didn't do well. But I was just like so unbelievably grateful at the time that like I didn't really care. I was still walking. I was still cashing a Broadway check every week.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to Times Square every day to go to work. I was like living the dream, playing a role nobody had ever played before. Like yeah. it was cool.
That's fun. And then yeah, American in Paris and Falsettos. Gosh, Falsettos was like lightning in a bottle. With that cast.
That was...
Christian Borle, Stephanie J. Block, Andrew Rannells, Tracy Tom, Betsy Wolf.
Yeah,
Anthony Rosenthal.
Yeah, I mean, it was...
Yeah.
That was like the pinnacle. That was, like you said, I mean, I always describe it as lightning in a bottle because it was one of those rare things where you love every single person you're working with. You love the material with all of your soul. You love going to work every day and you love doing it. The audiences love it. Critics love it. It was, yeah, I mean, it was just a perfect storm. And like, that never, ever happens.
Was that chemistry between the cast? Did you all know each other beforehand through any means?
Or
did you
really?
Really?
It was like,
casting?
I mean, I had a work session with a chemistry read, I guess, with Stephanie. It was like sort of my last audition in which was a very long process. And like as soon as I walked in the room and we made eye contact, I was like, oh wow, okay. And we did Making a Home, and it was like I will never, I remember every single detail of that moment. It was, yeah, again, it was lightning in a bottle.
Wow. Yeah, it was a great.
Thank you.
Run.
It was amazing.
It's a long, difficult show too. I mean, the whole thing is almost.
Yeah, but it was like the most satisfying exhaustion you could possibly imagine. You know what I mean? It was like running a marathon every day, but you're like, we just climbed Mount Everest and it was so satisfying.
Right. So now, then you did the band's visit, your replacement in the band's visit.
Uh-huh.
And now, Burn This. Tell everyone about Burn This.
Okay. I'm going to have to do this, unfortunately, quickly because I have fight call in 1 minute.
Oh, no. Okay.
But Burn This, it's Lanford Wilson's, you know, beautiful play about grief and loss. And it's just, you know, four people coming together. And dealing.
It is time for Fight Call. Fight Call, please, may I have cast to the stage.
Uh-oh.
Okay, wait, hold on. I'm going to finish this and then we can also pause and I can come back.
Oh, okay.
It's about four people sort of dealing with the loss of a very important person in their life and how that grief and that vulnerability and that pain forces you to look inward and sort of like reevaluate your life and your relationships. And find out what's important to you and what is meaningful to you and how like grief sort of opens you up to certain possibilities and closes you off to other possibilities. And I'm finally playing a fucking gay character on Broadway.
Let's put a pin in that.
Okay.
Let's go do your fight
all right,
call.
I'll be right back. Okay. I'll be right back.
And we're back. Are you all fighted up?
You know what's hilarious is like, I just sort of like float around the fight. Yeah, no, I'm all fighted out, but I'm not really involved in the fight very much.
So you were saying before the break that this is the first time you've actually gotten to play a gay character on stage.
Yeah, on Broadway.
On Broadway.
Yes. I mean, I have played gay characters before, but this is sort of my first, which is just so shocking to me. I don't know. It speaks to, and I think Broadway is much better at this than Hollywood is, but it just speaks to the lack of space for us in the storytelling world, in the performing arts. It's a hot button issue, and it's hard for me to like speak to one side of it or the other. Because I always do believe that the best person for the part should be playing the part. But there really is an imbalance. And until young gay people can see themselves playing themselves on screen or on stage, there will always be a problem and there will always be an imbalance. I mean, you know, I've been very lucky and I've gotten to play some amazing heterosexual characters. And I think that's probably maybe rare. It certainly is in Hollywood. And if they're not gay, then they're probably in the closet playing straight characters. Mm-hmm. But I think it's very important that we, you know, particularly with Burn This and plays of that era and that moment, it was a very important time for gay people to just see gay people on stage.
Yeah.
And, you know, just to be acknowledged and to just have their existence validated. But that's not enough anymore. I think we actually, because actors are no longer these like mysterious creatures with social, you know, now we have social media and the internet and transparency is mm-hmm. the norm. And we know a lot about people's personal lives. It's no longer just enough to see gay characters. We have to see gay people working and being a part of the workforce and being productive members of society, and that we are allowed, that we are not just we're not just tolerated, and that our existence is real, but that we are contributing to the greater good and the stories. And I think mm-hmm. that's so for me, it's very, this is very important, an important moment for me and for, you know, gay kids looking to, who have dreams of being on Broadway, that they can do it, and that there's space for them.
Well, very well said. Thanks. And since we are short on time, gosh, I feel like I could talk to you for another, like,
I love this. Four, this is, I mean, and hours. I love just like sitting here with these mics. I know, me too. I could talk about this shit for days.
Well, I'll have to come back and we
can
do...
Yeah, but let's do part two.
Okay, we'll do part two. But to end part one here, there's three closing questions that I ask everybody on the podcast.
Okay.
First, very simply, what motivates you?
Oh, God. I want, this sounds so strange, but young people, people who I used to be, young kids who I know feel the way that I did, and need a better model than I had, is what motivates me to keep going and to keep doing the work, is to be that thing that I didn't have.
Mm-hmm. And what advice would you give to your younger self and younger people listening now, starting out down a similar path?
Stop trying to be the people that you're not because they appear to be succeeding more than you. Go at your own pace and do things on your own time, so long as you are truly and 100% authentic to yourself. Never ever compare yourself to other people. It will get you nowhere. And you will never be that other person. And guess what? That other person will never be you. So stay true to yourself and trust your gut and don't convince people of anything else.
And then last question, if you could only see one show for the rest of your life, but you could see it as many times as you want, what show would you see?
Ragtime.
Wow, three for Ragtime. I think you're the third person who said Ragtime.
Really?
Yeah. Ragtime is a popular one.
I mean, obviously I'm like a little biased because I was a part of it, but I will say I took a road trip like not that long ago by myself, I was going somewhere to visit someone, and I put on the Ragtime cast album and sobbed. Like catharsis to the nth degree. It was, and I didn't realize, I don't know what it is about that score and about that story and about those people doing it. I could, for the rest of my days.
Wonderful. So people can connect with you on Instagram at Bran Uran.
That's right.
U-R-A-N. And then that's it, right?
You're yeah, that's me.
That's it on Instagram. You can get more of...
I mean, I'm on Twitter, but like I don't use Twitter. So Instagram. Yeah,
right,
yeah, yeah.
Instagram. Yeah. Cool. So you get more of me at theater_podcast on Instagram and Twitter, facebook.com/officialtheaterpodcast. Of course, listen and subscribe, rate and review. The ratings help tremendously. I read those. This is produced by Jillian Hockman. And then thank you, as always, to Jukebox the Ghost for the intro and outro music you hear right now. Brandon, thank you so much. This has been incredible.
Thank you for having me. This was so much fun.
We have to do a part two.
Yeah, we're going to do part two.
Okay, thank you so much.
Of course.
Take a deep breath, make the world a little colorful.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. and there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.